Good afternoon, Oral History Review readers. This is Yannikin Smucker. I'm the digital editor of the journal, and joining me today is Janice Fernheimer for another edition of OHR Conversations. Jan was one of the co-authors of a recent article in last summer's edition, the 2018 summer fall edition of Oral History Review. The article was in our pedagogy section titled Sustainable Stewardship, a Collaborative Model for Engaged Oral History Pedagogy, Community Partnership and Archival Growth, which is a topic that is of great excitement and interest to me because I, like Jan, teach with oral history in the classroom. So I'm very excited about uses of oral history and ways that we can engage students in the college classroom on this topic. She co-authored the article with Doug Boyd, who is the director of the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky Libraries, along with two other University of Kentucky faculty members, Beth Goldstein and Sarah Dorpinghouse, sorry about that. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about this collaboration and sort of the larger role of oral history in the classroom. So I'm going to start off by asking you, Jan, and thank you, by the way, for joining me, to describe how you've used oral history in the college classroom and how this project has grown out of previous endeavors as well.
Sure. So my early work with oral history dates back to about 2013, which is actually not that long ago, so I'm kind of new to this emerging world. But I come to it with a background in rhetoric and composition, and particularly an interest in the way that technology impacts how we teach and learn about writing processes. So my first job before I came to UK was at RPI, Rensselaer Polytech Institute. So I got really interested, thanks to my colleagues who were much more well-versed in usability and design and thinking about how different kinds of platforms maybe change the way that we think about our writing. And I've been teaching first-year writing for a really long time. So in 2013, I was kind of brought on to be part of this new curriculum that was interested in teaching first-year students how to write across multiple media, so how to become much more literate and well-versed in both oral, written, and digital technologies. And I don't know roughly how I got introduced to Doug. I started getting interested in oral history at that time, and someone said, oh, you really need to go talk to Doug. And I did, and he told me a little bit about OHMS, which, if you don't know what it is, it's the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer, also known as OHMS, but it's a kind of fancy word for an open source platform that enables people to create digitally searchable indexes that look kind of like a table of contents, but for audiovisual material. And it allows a researcher to get connected to the particular moment in an oral history where an interviewee or an interviewer mentions a particular keyword or concept. It's for anyone who's done any kind of work with audio materials and has been faced with the prospect of a box of cassette tapes at the bottom of some basement with nothing more than, like, these are the materials of X community to go on. OHMS is revolutionizing because it allows you to search the things that you weren't able to search before. And Doug had just kind of started doing, I hope I'm not misspeaking here, work with OHMS in the classroom. He had kind of imagined it as something that librarians and metadata professionals and oral historians would use to create indexes. And I wanted to put first year writers and other students in the classroom in the seat of the indexer, creating indexes for extant materials that had already been collected but were not yet really accessible or usable. So that was kind of, I don't want to talk too long. I know when you're listening, it's hard to listen to someone talk for a long time. But that's how I got interested. And so I started off with these two classes, one of first-year writers, honors first-year writers, and one of kind of sophomore writers who were fulfilling a writing requirement for the university. And we started working with some local collections about Lexington, Kentucky, to try and give students a more multifaceted sense of what it means to be a Lexingtonian. And so one was a multi-ethnic collection, one was a series of oral histories that were collected by a local author, Nora Rose Musnick, who wrote a book about Arab and Jewish shopkeepers in Kentucky. And the third was a set of oral histories collected by the Jewish community in roughly the 70s and 80s. And they were community-led oral histories. And so, of course, all these different projects, they kind of varied. There wasn't a standard protocol. The audio quality varied. It was kind of, you know, an exciting teaching adventure. But what we came away from those classes understanding was that indexing was a pretty valuable exercise for students to engage in, for thinking about audience, for thinking about themselves as researchers, and kind of imagining, okay, if I'm a researcher, how might I want to encounter this interview, and how might I help other people in the position of researcher encounter this interview? So that's kind of how I got started. Have I answered your question even?
Okay. Absolutely. And then, so, or at least the first part of the question about how the sort of kernel here, and then now this most recent project, which you wrote about, that's been the outgrowth of those initial efforts in the classroom, correct?
So what was really exciting about those projects is we could see that students were really interested in indexing, or at least in, and I'm gonna use my hands here because they were really on the front seat handling these other people's stories. And they felt a kind of, I'm gonna borrow Charlotte Nunez's words, but a kind of non-appropriative ownership over them. Like they really wanted to take care of them and make sure that they were representing them ethically and appropriately. But what we realized is if we kept going at this rate, we'd run out of interviews to index. Obviously my two little classes weren't gonna index all the hundreds of hours the Nun Center acquires every year, but there were some other things that were happening at the time. I also direct Jewish studies here at the University of Kentucky, and working with my colleague, Dr. Goldstein, and also Sarah Dorpinghaus, we were developing some models for undergraduate research scholars to get involved with undergraduate research. And we were also imagining a project in collaboration with the Jewish Heritage Fund for Excellence, who ended up funding the project initially, to the Jewish Kentucky Oral History Project, which was designed to collect narratives from Jewish Kentuckians across the Commonwealth. And so we wanted this project to highlight the diversity of Jewish voices, the fact that there actually are Jewish Kentuckians, and to give students access both to those narratives, but also to Jewish community members. And so that's, we started thinking about the experiences we had using, not using, but working with students to index extant materials. And so we started looking at those Jewish community conducted interviews as part of what might, what we might build upon for this larger Jewish Kentucky project. But we wanted to engage, we wanted students involved in that project at every step of the project. So accessioning materials that were already there, but also generating new materials, hence this idea for sustainable stewardship, so that students were both learning about Jewish community in Kentucky, and the American Jewish experience more broadly is encapsulated by the Jewish Kentucky experience, but also contributing to it by working with local community members, obviously who Dr. Goldstein and I identified that would be appropriate for students to work with, and conducting interviews of their own that then become part of the collection that future classes of students will then access for the very first time and index. Right. So we created this kind of loop where students would work with the materials that were generated by another class or a set of professionals the first time we did it. Through their work with that indexing experience, they kind of attuned their ears to what it meant to conduct a good interview, what were the kinds of things that could go wrong, or maybe the kinds of follow-up questions that you wish they'd asked that hadn't gotten answered. And that helps prepare them to do a better job of indexing or interviewing on their own when it became time for them to develop protocols in collaboration with Dr. Goldstein and I, with their community member and then to actually conduct the interview and then put those interviews together in some kind of public story or public history. So with my first year students, they often do audio casts that are kind of like This American Life. And so they would take one of the interviews they listened to that someone else indexed and one of the interviews that they conducted, and maybe they did some additional research, extra materials in the archives or somewhere else, and they put them together and tell a story. A well-researched story, but a story that they thought was important. And they'd identify an audience for whom that story was important to be told, so that, you know, we constructed some real writing experiences for them that had an audience beyond the classroom itself. I feel like I'm talking so long.
That's fantastic. I think that gives a lot of context for how your students were engaging with these materials. I have a follow-up here specifically about the audience, because I'm really interested in this public relationship. You know, this isn't writing that dreaded term paper that, like, no one ever looks at again at the end of the semester. So who do you imagine the audience for the project being?
So actually, I make the students think about who they want to talk to. So one group of students, and students often want to talk to other students, and that makes a lot of sense in a lot of cases. The professionally conducted interviews that the first kind of set that we had done, in fact, we had initially imagined this project as a very small project that would only detail Jewish life at the University of Kentucky, you know, a nice contained project of say 25 interviews to be accomplished over a few months. The funding agency had come back to us and like, oh no, we want something bigger and something that's much more capacious and inclusive of not just Lexington, but also Louisville and all of the rural communities as well. So in the first couple of semesters where we worked with students, one group, you know, focused specifically on those interviews. The interviews we did were from alums of a Jewish fraternity they were members in the 1950s, so many of them are in their 80s and 90s now. But they were also members of a Jewish student organization called Hillel, which exists on many campuses across the country and has a more than 80-year history here at UK. But most students aren't Jewish at UK and may have never heard of it. And so one group of, I think, almost entirely non-Jewish students did a kind of informational audio cast about the history of Hillel at UK aimed at other students. So that gave them a good way to gauge, okay, what do we need to explain? What can we take for granted? Obviously, if they were aiming that video at, say, I don't know, a much, maybe an East Coast university with a larger population of Jewish students, they might be able to take certain kinds of things for granted that they weren't able to take for granted with the audience they imagined here.
Right.
So that's like one example.
That's very useful to think. And I think so important for students to think beyond, oh, it's for the public, the public, the nebulous public who is sort of undefined. So it's really great to have them focus in a little bit more narrowly on who are you speaking to, who are you writing for, as part of the question as well. I want to loop back around to this idea of sustainable stewardship. So how did this concept emerge from the project? Speak a little bit more about how it's sustainable. I think you hinted at it grows on semester over semester, so it's not sort of confined to just one 15-week semester. But how do you envision this as a sustainable project?
Well, there are, I would say, like three different prongs on which we imagine this as sustainable. And the key partnerships and collaborations that the project brings together are institutions and organizations that imagine themselves in continued collaboration. I think that part is really important. So of course, my work with the Nunn Center, which predates the sustainable stewardship model, but really helped lay some of that wonderful working groundwork. So here you've got, you know, at a basic interdisciplinary level at the university, a faculty member from Jewish Studies and Rhetoric and Composition, the director of the Nunn Center. So we've got some interdisciplinarity there. But that also connects the library and primary sources of oral history in the classroom almost immediately. In the work that we were doing, having students working with OMS. Once we started working with my colleague, Dr. Goldstein, and also the Jewish Heritage Fund for Excellence, all of a sudden we have this community component, which is kind of loose and amorphous. For the purposes of the sustainable component at UK, it's mostly the Lexington Jewish community, but who exactly is that? There's a community of about 2,000 to 3,000 Jewish individuals who live here. There are two major synagogues, each with 100 years of history. Some people belong at both, some people belong at one or the other, some at neither. Some are involved in non-religious organizations like Hadassah or the Jewish Federation of the Bluegrass. So we use Jewish community to kind of loosely encompass all of that. Mm-hmm. And so we've got the classroom, the archive, and the community. And those are the three prongs of the partnerships that we see. And of course, Beth and I, Dr. Goldstein and I, are kind of uniquely situated in that we're both faculty members here at UK, but we're also active members and participants in the Jewish community itself here locally. Beth with many more years in Lexington than me. And so that helped to forge that connection, both opening up the university when our students are interviewing community members. It might be the first time a community member has come on campus, either since they were an undergrad here or ever. Mm-hmm. And it also opens up this community, this minority community that students, especially coming from all across the Commonwealth of Kentucky, may not have ever had the opportunity to meet a Jewish person personally, or to learn about practices or beliefs or community. And so that opens up that community, that gateway, both community to classroom, classroom to community. Last spring, we actually had community members join us in the library archives because this opened up another layer of library community partnership. Once we began to build some credibility with the community with the project we were doing, Sarah Dorpinghaus, Director of Digital Services at the library, was able to really move forward on some collecting initiatives, building the Jewish Kentucky collections here at the University of Kentucky Special Collections Resource Library. And so now, you know, when we started the project, there weren't a whole lot of materials. There were materials, but not from the local organizations. Now the Temple Adith Israel Synagogue, the Ohave Zion Synagogue, one is Reform, one is Conservative, the Jewish Federation of the Bluegrass, all of them have partnered with University of Kentucky Libraries to archive and preserve their materials. And that then upholds, filters back into the classroom. Students, while they're working on their indexes, looking for something to create a useful and contextual hyperlink, they'll go to the archival materials, digitize something, upload it to our beta Omeka site, and then link to it from the index. So now we've got this really rich index that's not just, oh, this person was president of the Federation. Oh, this person was president of the Federation. And look, here's this column they wrote for the community paper while they were president of the Federation, while you're experiencing that in the index itself. So that sustainability between the classroom, the community, and the university or the archives is allowing this to kind of grow out in a bunch of multiple directions. I don't know if I answered that as clearly as you'd like, so I'm happy to revisit part of that.
No, absolutely. And it brings up the question that sometimes, I think particularly this is true in the humanities where we are both professors, that we don't necessarily always have great avenues for collaboration. What has that brought to your own work, this idea of having partners, both community partners and also interdisciplinary across the university campus? How has that impacted your work?
It's a tremendous richness. I get so energized by my work with my collaborators on this project, but also our undergraduate collaborators. Because I teach first year writing and many of the students work on this project through a first year writing model, I get to work with undergraduates from across the disciplines. So two students who started out in first year writing, one was a Paducah native, and she got really interested in the lost Jewish history of Paducah. What do you mean there are all these Jews there in the 19th century? What? But she got really excited. She was a pre-med student, Hannah Newberry, and she decided to keep working on the project. And so she ended up taking an independent study with me and doing research and conducting her own interviews in her native Paducah, some with her own family who had lived memories and experience of the Jewish community, and some with actual Jewish community members who are still there and practicing. She'll be presenting some of that work at posters at the Capitol in Frankfurt, in front of our legislators, which is exciting, and at the National Conference on Undergraduate Research. But that kind of interdisciplinarity, both, I guess, the short answer is the interdisciplinarity with my colleagues has really opened me up to interdisciplinarity with students as well, and has enabled us to give students who wouldn't necessarily think of research, I mean, for them, research, for my science students often, research is what you do in the lab. Yeah, right. Research is what you do, I don't know, under the microscope with like genes right. and things. But for these students, this is research too, and for both them and for me, it's been equally invigorating to see them discover this as research that they value, that they enjoy. And it's not either or, it's both and, right? The other student is another pre-med student who did work on Jewish hospital in Louisville. So she took her interest in science, but she was really interested in how Jewish values impacted these, you know, where did these idea of Jewish hospitals come from, and what was the exigence for the development of these hospitals, and why does it still exist in Louisville, even though it's changed ownership all these times? So she did another independent study, started doing interviews with people involved with Jewish hospital and connecting it back to her own interests in science and medical innovation and research. So that's like two student examples of how that works. But that's, to me, that's like the apex, I don't know, the absolute joy and delight of working with students is watching those light bulbs go off and see them make connections across where they come from disciplinarily and kind of where they can imagine themselves going once they've been exposed to something different.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. I mean, particularly in today's higher ed environment where we're encouraged to have these high impact learning experiences. This example
right, right.
That. And
we're also, like the poster child for high impact learning.
And all the more so, particularly when, there's so much emphasis on this, on STEM and the sciences as where a lot of this innovation takes place. But look here, you're taking pre-med students and exposing them to this whole richness that is so complementary in many ways to what they're already doing. It's really fantastic.
And I have to say, like my colleagues, working with my colleagues across the disciplines has really helped me to be able to not be open to it, because I've always been open to it, but to have, you know, multiple sets of disciplinary eyes through which to look at the way students might encounter this work. So whether it's my colleague at education policy and curriculum development, or Doug's eyes through the Dr. Goldstein, or Doug's eyes from the oral history, and you know, how do we make this accessible, and the kind of usability aspects, and when we're dealing with audiences, and how do we connect them, how do we use the technological interface. We've got, you know, we had a computer science student trying to do some voice recognition. Oh. Kinds of, you know, could we do that on this closed set? You know, was there enough, was it small enough subset? And it turns out, you know, the programming skills weren't quite where they needed to be in the subset, but it was an interesting question that we wouldn't have really raised if we hadn't encountered these different students, and those students hadn't encountered our various and different sets of expertise. Without Sarah on the team, I wouldn't be able to prepare all of those archival materials. I mean, I don't, they do help me get the boxes in order, but also, you know, talk in an educated way about what metadata is and why it's so important that students are authoring that, and to think about metadata as a kind of writing.
Exactly.
You know, I think that that's really exciting.
Definitely. So I want to conclude today by asking what you envision the next phase of this project. By its design, it's sustainable and ongoing. So what's happening next?
So a couple of different things. We've been working hard to get the pedagogical model up and running. And I think that we're, you know, after this is the spring semester I'm teaching two courses, the upper division and the lower division. I think it's the third time I'm teaching the lower division and the second time I'm teaching the upper. I feel like, okay, we're finally getting our rhythm here. And that's setting up a nice flow for both interviews to get indexed and made publicly accessible, so that they can actually be accessed by people who are interested in doing research, and the students are creating the next set of interviews that will be indexed by the next set of students. So that's a nice flow that we have going. But the other aspect of that, of course, is the university community component. And Dr. Goldstein's been working with some individuals in the Lexington Havara, which is a community partnership. So we're working to actually, you know, we've had the students interviewing community members, and to actually get community members interviewing other community members to generate interviews that will either then be indexed by other community members or indexed by the students in the classroom. It's unclear. So that's kind of, that's the next round of sustainability in the community. And then as we were talking a little bit before we began officially, we've been working on this beta site in Omeka to deepen the kinds of indexes that students, deepen's not really the right word, enrich the kind of indexes students are able to produce by integrating the archival materials that have been donated by the community to the university, getting access by the students, and synced back up with the interviews to give better access back to the community. So we're working to develop that interface and to create and think about some partnerships between the classroom and the community that help get certain kinds of digital humanities work done that's mutually beneficial for the students, the community, and the archives. So like last spring, it was super basic, very simple task, right? The community has all these photos, nobody's identified. The students are like, okay, we can put this in Omeka. We don't have any idea who these people are. But to work with the community members to get a small subset of photos identified, and they did, you know, they create a little exhibit and they have all of the names mostly spelled correctly. I think we're still working out some of the kinks on that. But it was a pretty simple project, but it gave students that access to community members and their expertise. And I thought that was a really interesting opportunity for both the community and the students, and to use the technology that's available to us to help accomplish some tasks that were mutually rewarding for everyone who was involved with it.
Yeah, that's great. I love the community partnership, bringing those people in as stakeholders in the project. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I wanna thank you, Jan, for sharing about this classroom experience. Again, the article that Jan co-wrote for the Oral History Review is Sustainable Stewardship, a Collaborative Model for Engaged Oral History Pedagogy, Community Partnership, and Archival Growth. And I highly recommend this article to anyone who's interested in teaching with oral history in the classroom. It really, it gets into some of the important step-by-step aspects. There's a little bit of, you know, how-to in there, but more importantly, it really helps us understand why it's worth doing projects like this that, of course, take more time and more labor for instructors and for archival partners, but why the payoff is so huge. And it's really apparent from reading the article what that big payoff is. So that was in the most recent issue of the Oral History Review and the summer fall edition from 2018. Available. You can see the link here on the blog. Do go check it out. And I look forward to hearing how these projects continue to evolve. I'm very excited to see the Omeka website launch hopefully soon as well. Look forward to that. Thank you so much for your time today, Jan. It's been a pleasure talking
with you. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure. And also, I have to say, I can't believe I didn't say it earlier, but thank you so much for your work in this area, because I have to say a lot of the work that we've done in both the indexing project and the sustainable stewardship project stands on the shoulders of some giants. In fact, the one sitting in front of me across the computer screen right now, but the tremendous work that you've done with Doug and the Going North project and with Charlie, that Charlotte's been doing, thinking about stewardship. There's this really exciting group of scholars who is working to engage students with oral history, and we are by far not alone, but we are standing on the shoulders of all of those giants and thinking through.
I love that now we have a sort of a community of people who are all engaged with this. So it's exciting to see how we can all collaborate and move forward and be inspired by one another's work going forward.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Once again, this is OHR Conversations. Stay tuned for the next edition.